morning, we want to welcome you all for our second hearing on the October calendar. And we especially want to welcome the Oconomowoc High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. Seated. And we also have students from Heritage Christian. Would they please stand? And thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. And the program is entitled Court with Class. Students across the state are invited to come and attend an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, students are sent material about the case they're about to hear and may have done some extra activities revolving around this case. They come, listen to oral argument, and then meet with the justice of the court and discuss the procedures of the court in taking and deciding cases. The discussion is not about the substantive legal issues involved in the cases. Everyone is welcome to come and participate in that after the second argument. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Roberts. And seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack, with whom you'll meet after this case. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the second case 07AP2651, Pawlowski versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Now, The lineup here is 20 minutes for attorney Sandra Hupfer, 25 minutes for Michael Siddell, Ms. Hupfer representing American Family Mutual, and Nancy Seifelt, Mr. Siddell representing Colleen Pawlowski and Thomas Pawlowski, 5 minutes for Sandra Hupfer in rebuttal, 5 minutes for Attorney Ross Meisel in sir rebuttal, and 5 minutes for Attorney Hupfer in response to the sir rebuttal. Is that correct? Okay. Ms. Hupfer.
May it please the court, Supreme Court Justices.
Counsel, we're going to have trouble hearing you.
Okay.
All right, let's try it. Speak up, please.
May it please the court. Can you hear me now? Supreme Court Justices, Mr. Siddle and Mr. Ross Meisel. I am Sandra Hupfer, and I represent the defendants, petitioners, Nancy Seifelt and American Family Mutual Insurance Company in this case. The relevant facts surrounding this case are brief. The petitioner, Nancy Seifelt, allowed Walter Waterman and his two dogs to move into her residence in June 2003. Waterman had recently lost his job and needed a place to stay that would allow him to have his dogs with him. Seifelt owned dogs of her own and possessed a large fenced-in backyard. Waterman paid no rent but performed some household repairs in exchange for a place to stay. About 3 months after he moved in, one of Waterman's dogs injured a pedestrian, the plaintiff respondent, Colleen Pawlowski. When Waterman, while leaving the house to go to the store, opened the front door to Seifelt's home and allowed the dogs to run out ahead of him without a leash. Seifelt was on the premises but somewhere else in the home. She was not in the immediate vicinity of the event. She did not know it occurred until the police came to her home to question her later that day. There are two main issues before the court today. First, whether Ms. Seifelt was an owner under Wisconsin Statute 174.02, as owner is defined in 174.001, and second, whether public policy precludes a finding of liability. Because the petitioners believe that public policy is very significant in this case, we're starting our argument with that issue. Wisconsin Statute 174.02 imposes strict liability on a dog owner for injuries caused by a dog. We are here today making a public policy challenge to the application of this statute to my clients in this case. We're authorized to do so by Fandry versus Connell, a 2004 Wisconsin Supreme Court case. Fandry specifically held that Wisconsin courts may utilize the traditional six public policy factors, formerly referred to as proximate cause, to limit liability in appropriate cases under 174.02. The goal of 174.02 is to protect innocent third parties from injuries caused by a dog. And the statute does this first by imposing strict liability, and by that it relieves the plaintiff of the burden of proving negligence. And second, it does so by placing the liability on the person or persons who have the ability to prevent the injury. How do you prevent injury? You do it by controlling the dog. Therefore, in addition to holding the legal owner of the dog liable for injuries, the statute broadens the definition of owner to include keepers and harborers of the dog. Petitioners do not believe that keepers and harborers were included in the definition of owner in an effort to capture every person who had access to the dog into a net of liability. Rather, we submit that keepers and harborers were added because it's a common occurrence for dogs to be cared for and controlled by individuals other than their legal owners.
Ms. Huffer, can I interrupt you for a minute? You're going first, apparently, on the argument of public policy. And I know that you're aware of the fact that in a lot of our cases, we've said there ought to be a trial first. All of the facts ought to be developed first before a judge applies public policy. Now, I also recognize we haven't always been consistent, but what's your response to an argument that this case ought to be tried out first before public policy considerations are applied to the question of liability?
Your Honor, I think the facts in this case are clear enough, and I don't know that a trial would add too much to it. As the Court's aware from reading the briefs, Waterman was not made a party to this case, and neither the plaintiff nor the defendant could locate Waterman. So the testimony we have about what happened is essentially what's in the affidavits. There were no other witnesses. We have Ms. Pawlowski's testimony, and we have Ms. Seafeld's testimony about what happened. That's been submitted in affidavits appended by both attorneys in the summary judgment motions for purposes of the motion and this appeal. Petitioners don't believe that any additional facts would be developed if we had a trial in this case, so we think this case is appropriate.
Counsel, I'm a little surprised that you're starting with six public policy factors because that occupied only two paragraphs at the very end of your brief. Do you think that's your strongest argument? Why are you starting with that argument?
I think both arguments are equally important, but I think because I have the opportunity to argue public policy, I think that as I reflected on this case and prepared for oral argument, I felt that the more I reread the cases, I felt that there was more I wanted to add to the public policy argument. And given the nature of the question and answer session here, I was concerned I might not get to it if I left it to the end of the case. So I thought I would bring it forward at the front.
Is your public policy argument as set forth in paragraph 14 of your brief, in the first paragraph, which says the Court of Appeals decision in this case is contrary to public policy? A landlord property owner should not be liable for injuries caused by a dog when she does not own the dog, is not in control or custody of the dog, and merely permits the dog and its owner to live in her home in exchange for performing repairs. Is that the public policy that you are advancing, or is the public policy argument that you are advancing as set forth in paragraph 16 of your one paragraph cites the Maxwell case, of course, which was a negligence case, didn't have any strict liability. There was no, both parties, it was a concession, there was no owner there. And then the next paragraph on page 16, which goes through six public policy factors. What is your public policy argument, both or one or the other?
I would say both, but I think that when you look at the six public policy factors, essentially five of the six do apply, and the one on fraud does not apply. But I really think the fourth and the sixth factors are the strongest. That are, first, I think it's unreasonable to burden Seafelt with strict liability under the statute. And the sixth one is basically dovetails into it, I think, where allowing recovery would have no sensible or just stopping point in a case like this. I think that effectively here it results in a pure penalty to Ms. Seafelt for harboring or keeping a dog, because under Ketting versus Conroy, a case that's been mentioned, a 1936 Wisconsin case in both briefs, and under the Court of Appeals ruling in this case, Ms. Seafelt would be responsible for any injury or damages caused by this dog wherever it goes.
Are you acknowledging that Seafelt harbored the dog?
At various points in time, going back to the other argument, I don't acknowledge he was a harborer necessarily at the point of the injury or at the time of the incident, but at various points in time, she certainly met the definition of harborer and keeper, I think, while the dog lived in her home, whether I don't believe she was either at the time of this incident.
What does harbor mean?
Well, that's the courts have discussed both the definitions of shelter and harbor. There is some kind of intermingling, I think, of the terms.
Keeper and harbor.
Of keeper and harbor. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
What does harbor mean?
I think harbor does mean to provide some protection or some shelter to the dog, and I think it also implies that there's control.
At the time of the incident, it's your position that Seafelt did not harbor the dog, wasn't providing housing for the dog. Is that correct?
I believe that the owner intervened and stepped in and took control of the dog. So her harboring, in the sense that she was providing shelter or protection to the dog, came to an end when the legal owner of the dog stepped in and took control of the dog.
If he would have exited the back door rather than the front door and was 1 foot outside of the back door, would that cease or terminate Seafelt's harboring?
I think it's the question of him taking control of the dog. I don't think the question is exactly whether the door was open or closed, or he was 1 foot in or 1 foot out of the home. I think it's the issue of the control by the owner, not necessarily the proximity to the structure.
Let me then amplify. If he were taking the dogs out the back door rather than the front door, would Seafelt, under those facts, everything else being the same, under those facts, would Seafelt terminate being a harborer?
I think it would still terminate. I don't understand the significance of the back door or the front door in your question.
Mm-hmm. And so if, is it your position anytime the legal owner takes the dog outside of the house where the dog is staying for an extended period of time, that terminates harbor status?
Yes, temporarily. And if he comes back and reenters the home, then the harbor status would be reinstituted.
And so if he were going out the front door with the two dogs, and he goes out the front door, and her status, Seafelt's status as harborer, terminates, but then he forgets his keys, and in 3.5 seconds he turns around and goes back in the house with the dogs, then her status as harborer is reinstated?
No, because he's still in control of the dogs.
So he can be in control of the dogs within the house, and she is not a harborer. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so for purposes of the statute.
I mean, that's what I'm saying is correct. Under your analysis, the dogs can be in the house, And if he is interacting with the dogs, then she loses her status as harborer. Is that your position?
Yes, ma'am.
And what if the dogs are in the house and both of them are interacting with the dogs, then what?
He's not in exclusive control, so I think there would be dual liability in that situation.
Mm-hmm. But she, even though the dogs are in the house, she's not legally a harborer if he is... if he is sitting on the sofa and watching TV and they are on the floor in front of him, then she's not a harborer.
I think we're getting a closer question than whether the owner was in control of the dog at that point or in exclusive control of the dog at that point.
Well, how does that make sense with the cases that say the dog is in the kennel, the employee was injured in the kennel, and sues the plaintiff? It sues the owner of the dog who kenneled it. And the case says, no, you can't sue, the employee can't sue the owner of the dog because both of them are owners. The employee is the owner because he had control and dominion over the dog. And the owner is the owner because they had title to the dog. So in that case, you had two owners, one who wasn't even present. So if we accept your argument that you made to Justice Bradley, it seems to me that you'd be asking us to reverse that case.
No, Your Honor, I believe you're referring to Armstrong.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In Armstrong, the court found that the legal owner was responsible even in the absence.
That's right. So why can't the legal owner in this case be responsible? No, your client is not the legal owner.
Right.
But your client is an owner if your client keeps or harbors. Right?
Correct.
Because owner, keeper, harbor are treated exactly the same in the statute.
That's true. However, I think that the legal owner's ownership transcends the statute. And by that I mean that outside of that situation of the statute, the owner always owns the dog until he gives up legal ownership. And as legal owner, he makes decisions about the dog. He makes decisions about where it's going to stay. He makes decisions about training the dog. He makes decisions about who's going to keep the dog. So I think there's actually some logic for keeping the legal owner responsible even when he's not present, because he has this umbrella of ownership. He's really in control of a lot of the things in the dog's life that may even cause it to bite or not bite, or all those different things. So I think keeping the legal owner responsible in all situations has some logic.
So but not all owners are treated equally, in your opinion, under the statute?
I don't think that they should be, no.
Counsel, how does your position square with a couple of cases, but let me focus on Fire Insurance Exchange case. How does your position, and I'm reading from paragraphs 15 and 16 of that case, and in Fire Insurance Exchange is discussing the Ketting case, and it said in paragraph 15 and 16 that a keeper of a dog is a person who exercises some measure of custody, care, or control. So control isn't the only important thing. It could be custody or care or control. And then paragraph 16 says, and in an earlier case, Ketting versus Conroy, where both the owner and one alleged to be the keeper were sued, an argument was made that if the owner is in control of the dog, another who is a keeper could not also be held liable. The Supreme Court rejected that argument, stating it is inconsistent with the purpose of the statute. Then it goes on in paragraph 17 saying the purpose of the statute is to assign responsibility to those in the position to protect innocent third parties. But I hear your argument saying, look, if Waterman is in the house and he's in control of the dog, then Seafeld is no longer a harborer or a keeper. That seems inconsistent with paragraph 16 of the fire insurance case.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that at the time of the incident that Seafeld was caring for the dog. I don't believe that she was in custody of the dog. I don't believe that she was controlling the dog. So I think it is consistent with it.
But your argument is that control trumps everything. That's what I heard your argument to be. That is, if Waterman were in the house and in control, then she cannot be a legal owner. That is, cannot be considered a harborer.
That's correct.
Control is everything in your argument.
I think it has to be when the legal owner steps in.
Okay, and how do you deal with that language that in Fire Insurance Exchange, which says, hey, look at the Ketting case, where both the owner and one alleged to be a keeper were sued. An argument was made that if the owner is in control, then the keeper, then that trumps. And this case said, hey, that argument was rejected in Ketting.
Well, I have a problem with Ketting, and I think that it conflicts with Janssen. That is something I pointed out in my brief. I think that Ketting really isn't a very well-decided case. I think it was poorly reasoned. I think the court got sidetracked with family relationships in it that didn't have anything to do with the statute.
You have a problem with Fire Insurance Exchange because that case also says that that argument is inconsistent with the purpose of the statute. If one is the keeper of a dog, he's made responsible by the statute for injuries inflicted by it.
I think the keeper is responsible. I agree with the principle of the statute. I just think here we have to look at the inquiry of who the keeper is.
Does the comparative negligence statute apply in cases like this?
Yes. Even though it's a strict liability statute, you are allowed to consider negligence of the parties and to compare the negligence. If you have a trial and the verdict, there's no question of that in this case, Your Honor, because we have no issue that Ms. Pawlowski contributed to. But comparative negligence is considered when you apply the 174.02, yes.
Where's Waterman?
Pardon me?
Where is Mr. Waterman?
We don't know.
Would Waterman be on the special verdict
when comparing negligence? He could be on if one of the parties requested that in the facts of the testimony at trial adduced that there was that they should both be responsible. They could both be on there. Obviously, there couldn't be a collection from him if he wasn't a party, but he could be placed on the verdict if there was sufficient evidence and the court ruled that it was appropriate.
So in theory, the jury could find he's 100% responsible.
In theory, they could, yes.
How does that comport with strict liability? In the special verdict question, when you talk about comparative negligence, if I recall, the statute says, starts out, except as provided in 895, subject to 895.045 and 895.57.4, and one of those is the contributory negligence,
that's
not
correct.
Comparative negligence.
Yes,
contributory negligence, right? There's
yes.
a difference between contributory negligence and comparative negligence. And here you're talking about contributory negligence plays a part. Is that correct?
Yes, you're right, Your Honor.
And when you compare the conduct of the defendant with the conduct of the dog. That's what's compared, right?
The plaintiff?
No.
No, I'm sorry,
no.
I misunderstood.
In the special verdict question, if you look at 19.30 in the Wisconsin jury instructions, civil, that sets forth a special verdict that's proposed in strict liability dog bite. And what's compared is the conduct of the dog and the plaintiff's negligence, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I believe the Fire Insurance Exchange case did involve a law that was a little different. It was a contribution action that was brought where one party could sue the other, the owner could sue the keeper.
Or contribution.
Correct. Right. But I think you could do it as part of as a practical matter at the trial court level if you didn't have a separate lawsuit for contribution.
believe my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and then so for your response to Sir Rebuttal. Attorney Michael Siddle, counsel for Colleen Pulaski and Thomas Pulaski.
Yeah, please, the court. Let's talk here firstly. My name is Mike Siddle, and I represent the plaintiffs, Colleen and Tom Pulaski. Your Honor, I think the way to examine this case is to look at some of the statutory language. If the definition of owner first came into effect in about 1979, that's 174001, that's the first time where owner was separately defined and included a harbor or a keeper. Prior to that, Section 174 didn't, and this would be applicable to the cases, the Kading case and the Jansen case back in the 20s and the 30s. And Section 174 simply said an owner or a keeper would be liable. And now, after 1979, it says the statute changed and it says the owner will be liable, and then defines owner as a harbor and keeper. And the difference, I think, there is that statutorily the word harborer was added to the statute as an owner. So you could be a legal owner of that dog for the purposes of the statute if you had legal title to the dog, if you were a keeper of the dog, or if you were a harborer of the dog. And the legislature usually doesn't put words in that shouldn't have an effect in the statute, so I don't think that harbor and keeper are necessarily the same or interchangeable as
they were. What did the Court of Appeals say?
Pardon me?
What did the Court of Appeals characterize the defendant as?
Harborer.
Harborer.
And I think it was somewhat interchangeable. If there's a footnote in Patterman, which refers to an ALR article, and it says as follows, it's footnote 4. Courts usually distinguish keeping from harboring. Courts generally define keeping as exercising some measure of care, custody, or control over the dog, while harboring is often defined as sheltering or giving refuge to the dog. And the court, that footnote goes on to say, nonetheless, because harbor and keeper do appear distinguishable, and statute should be construed in a manner to avoid making words superfluous. I can never say that.
Well, if you shelter it, don't you care for it? Or have custody of it?
I think you do, Aaron.
So it seems to me that if so, keeper is not necessary in that statute. Harbor is so broad, it covers everybody.
Well, I think that the whole purpose of that, if that statute, the purpose is to protect the innocent third parties who have no control over the dog, and the statute makes no difference in definition or legal ownership between a titled owner and a keeper that's an owner. So just as a owner of the dog can be held liable when that person is not present, so a harborer of the dog can be held liable when the harborer is not present at the time of the attack.
Is there any different liability between a title owner, a harborer, and a keeper?
No.
Are all their liabilities the same?
Correct.
So here, Mr. Seafeld is performing a good deed. She's giving shelter to a man and his dogs, right? She exercises no control over that dog once that door was opened and the dogs were in control of the owner, right?
She doesn't have to, Judge. It's not necessary in statute because she's still harboring the dog.
Can she ever not harbor the dog? What does she have to do, kick out the dogs and the guy?
Absolutely. As long as the dog is residing, is domiciled at Mrs. Seafeld's residence, she is a harborer of that dog. And just because the dogs go out and go to the park or go to the store, she does not lose that status as a harborer. no different than her going to the store. She doesn't lose herself as a resident of that household. And I think it makes sense, and it makes all these other cases make sense, if you look at the harborer, and the harborer is going to remain an owner so long as that person continues to harbor the dog. So as long as that dog resides in the resident, is a resident of that household. That way all of these cases make sense, and it also comports with the purpose of the statute, the legislative intent, and goes a long way to protect the innocent third parties.
I had a bowl of water and a bowl of food, and this dog from the neighborhood, I don't know if anyone owns it or it's just loose, comes every day at 9, eats the food, drinks the water, hangs around or doesn't hang around, and then bites somebody. Am I a harborer?
I doubt it. I doubt you are. I think that would be a transient situation.
Well, take care of it? Am I a keeper?
Could be. I don't know how much control you would have, but you could be. That would be a closer question. But here, we've got the dog's living in the house for 3 months, the owner of the dog living in the house for 3 months, the owners and the dogs living there after this incident happened. I mean, if we took American Family's position, if he's out in the backyard with that dog, and Mrs. Seafelt's out in the backyard, and the neighbor kid wanders in and gets bit, that she would not be liable, jointly liable, as a harborer of that dog, as a keeper of that dog. I think there's times when she can be a keeper of that dog, and that may switch back and forth, but not a harbor when the dogs reside at that location.
Well, there's a case, and I'm sorry I've forgotten the name of it, but where the mom leaves town, puts the kid's dog in a kennel, the kid takes out the dog from the kennel, contrary to instructions of mom, the dog bites somebody, and the mom wasn't liable, right?
That's the Jansen case, Your Honor, and
maybe she was the owner, maybe she wasn't. I don't know how old the kid was. I don't know where the title to the dog actually was. But clearly, she harbored the dog. She owned the house.
There's no question about that. That case.
So why wasn't she liable?
Well, in that case, Judge, she bought the dog for her 14-year-old son.
Yep.
It was licensed in his name. It was titled in his name. He was the legal owner.
Right.
She was a keeper, no question about it.
Harborer.
She leaves, puts it in this animal hospital
right.
with instructions that it's to stay there until she comes back.
Right.
Then her 14-year-old son is at a neighbor's house, not at her residence, but at a neighbor's house, and gets that parent to go and pay the $2 to get the dog out of the hospital, brings it to the neighbor's house, ties it in the backyard, and then it bites somebody.
Okay.
But clearly, she relinquished her keeper status as long as she was out of town and that dog was in the hospital.
Yeah, but so did Ms. Seafield relinquish her keeper or harbor's status when the dog left with the owner and was under the owner's control. What difference does it make? And how does that compare with the fire insurance case, which held that the owner who put it in an animal welfare in a shelter, the owner was was liable to the employee?
Well, in that case, the person that was bit was a minor volunteer employee of the animal, the Humane Society. And the court also indicated they had to go back on an issue of fact.
The owner was liable. The owner was liable.
The owner was liable, as it should be, because that's what the statute says, whether he's there or not. But the keeper, the agency, was also liable.
Yeah, but we started out this argument that the owner, keeper, and border and harbor are all treated the same under the statute. They're all owners.
Right, they're all treated the same, but there is points in time, specifically Jansen says, where she relinquished her keeper, her harboring status. And the facts of that case are very clear. I mean, she takes the dog, she puts it in the animal hospital with instructions it's not to be removed. So she wasn't caring for the dog in that house. She wasn't harboring for that period of time.
Mr. Siddle, Mr. Waterman was at the Seafelt house, I believe that's right, for 3 months. Suppose this incident had occurred on the first day. Same result in your opinion?
Same result. if the dogs were harboring and staying there, became residents of that household, domiciled there, that's the way the statute makes the most sense. Especially since the legislature changed the definition of owner and added the word harbor in 1979. So it could be any one of those three. And when you're talking about keeper, they usually talk about the three C's, the care, custody, and control. And you could have some of those, or you couldn't have some at any particular given time. So when they just have keeper talking about that, it may be harder to distinguish some of these cases, but in the law that was in effect at the time of this incident, harbor is a legal owner. That would have to be a keeper.
Let me follow up. Suppose I opened a motel, and a lot of people have come to my motel, and some of those folks have dogs, so I permit dogs, people with dogs, to come to my motel. Am I going to be a keeper or harborer if one of those dogs bites people?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that would be more like the landlord-tenant situation.
Well, they're getting shelter. They're in a room. They're getting shelter. They're not required to sleep in the car. You just told me a couple minutes ago that...
Yeah, but you as the owner aren't harboring them. They're not. If you had them in your residence, yes, you would be a legal owner. But just because you allow some of your tenants to have it, that's just like the Hagenau case. And Gonzalez and Malone all indicated that off-premises landlords are not owners or keepers of dogs. You have to be an owner or keeper, harbor.
Mr. Siddle, let me shift the questioning a little bit and move to public policy. Your opposing counsel said five of the six factors apply here. And she argued that the fourth and sixth factors were the strongest ones. The fourth factor is that there's too unreasonable a burden placed on the alleged tortfeasor. And the sixth one is there's no just stopping point. How do you respond to the argument that public policy is what should be applied here to prevent liability?
First, we're not dealing with common law negligence, and I think that's an important factor. We're dealing with strict liability. As cited in the amicus brief, there's 368,000 dog bites a year that require emergency room treatment, and half of those are children under 14. The legislature took attempts to try to deal with that, to make owners and people that are caring for dogs and keeping dogs and harboring dogs responsible, as opposed to innocent third parties. This is exactly the case we have here. You've got Waterman who disappeared, who's not going to be responsible for this injury to Colleen. So the keeper, the harborer, is responsible. This is exactly the purpose of the statute. So I don't think that can be argued here. And there is a just stopping point. If you don't harbor the dog, then you're not at fault and you're not responsible. If you harbor the dog, you are. And I think there's a difference between common law negligence and the public policy reasons for not extending liability to the landlord in fire exchange that allowed the tenant to have those half wolves, those hybrid dogs on the property, and it mauled that year and a half old girl, and the police had been out there many, many times, and the court said for public policy reasons we're not going to extend the negligence law.
But Fandry was a statutory case.
Pardon me?
Fandry, which applied public policy, was a statutory case. That is, it was a case under the statute. And it said, regardless of the fact that it's under the statute, you can apply public policy, even when the exact words of the statute cover.
Well, in this case, you know, it would just gut the statute. It would gut 174.02 in the definition of ownership if the court rules that in a situation like this, if the mailman was standing on the porch and the dog bit the mailman in this situation, would there still be no liability for Mrs. Seafelt? If there was a child in the backyard and she wasn't home and he was, and the child wandered into the backyard and was bit, would she escape liability because she wasn't there as a harborer? I think that would be contrary to the whole purpose of the statute.
Do we have to overrule Fandry?
No. Not at all.
Counsel, I want to return to your answer to Justice Prosser's question about what if this had happened on the first day and you said liability. How does that comport with a discussion in Patterman about a temporary situation or a transient situation? In that circumstance, of course, it was less than a whole day. It was a half an hour. But the language discusses if it's a casual presence of a dog on someone's premises, you know, the dog's transient stay at of Sally's home while the family finished preparations. I mean, sometimes I would think that having a dog at your place for one day might be transient or might be a more casual presence consistent with Patterman. I don't know the answer to that question.
I agree with you, Justice. I think we would need to know more facts. Was it the intent of Waterman on that first day to stay there for a couple of months or a couple of weeks or just one night? I think that would make a difference in how you would analyze her as a harborer. Without more facts, I'm not sure how that would come out.
If you were to prevail in this case and it goes back for some sort of trial, how does Mr. Waterman factor into this in terms of his responsibility, his liability?
He doesn't. There's dual liability here for the owner of the dog and the keeper of the dog. And there's no evidence of negligence on the part of Colleen. The trial is simply on the issue of damages.
So Seafelts would be 100% liable?
Correct. She is equally, and Waterman could be 100% liable, and we could collect against either if we had sued him and he was available. There's dual liability when you have the bundle of ownership separated with care, custody, harboring, keeping the dog. They had not merged all back together in Waterman at the time of this injury. Mrs. Seafelt continued to harbor that dog. Waterman wasn't harboring the dog.
I suppose both of them were present, but Mr. Waterman had no insurance and no money. If you're saying that the entire burden would fall on the Seafelts?
That's what the case law says, Your Honor. She would then have a right of contribution against Waterman if there was, because they'd be joint tortfeasors. Or maybe that would be the common law.
Do you think if the word harbor was in the statute at the time Jansen was decided, that case would have been decided the same way?
Yes.
Why?
Because they use that word interchangeably oftentimes with keeper. And here, she ceased harboring the dog when she did a specific act to relinquish her keeper status by going to the hospital, turning the dog over, instructions that it's to stay there. The dog wasn't being harbored at her house for the period of time she was out of town for that funeral.
So if
but
the... Go ahead.
The owner, the 14-year-old, he was still liable under those circumstances because of his ownership.
As a practical matter, who pays for the 14-year-old, the judgment against the 14-year-old?
Well, that's why they're trying to get the mother.
Counsel, I looked at the statutory history, and it really wasn't a model of a clear trajectory. How is that? In 1935, and that's the year I pulled, that was when the Ketting case was decided. And then the word harbor did appear in 174, but not 174.02. that appeared in 174.05 dealing with dog licenses. But it said that in 174.05, the word owner, when used in Chapter 174 of the statutes in relation to possession of dogs, shall include every person who owns, harbors, or keeps the dog. So it's kind of tucked away, but it's not in 174.02. Does that fact that it was in 174.05 in any way change your argument or analysis?
No, Your Honor, I think it adds to it because so many of those cases back then were decided about animals injuring animals, dogs injuring sheep and other farm animals. And it talked about the liability of the harborer, of usually the parent. The kid owns the dog attacks the sheep. There was quite a number of those cases where they all held the parent responsible as the harborer or keeper of the dog, and they used that term back then.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to have used it more when the dog was injuring other animals.
You got double damages if the dog injured an animal, and you got treble damages if the dog injured a person. That seems right to me.
Well, I think all of the cases can be reconciled. Kading, Armstrong, Pfeiffer and Dix. Pfeiffer and Dix is interesting again because that shows that an owner, it's a case where the owner lent his bear hunting dog to a friend who wanted to practice up for the season, and that person brought another person with him who was injured. And the owner of the dog, who wasn't present, you know, tried to say, hey, I'm not liable because I wasn't there. And the court said, no, the statute says you're liable because you're the owner. You don't have to be there. And they make no distinction between which type of owner in any of these cases. So an owner is liable whether they're present or not. That seems to be...
Liability is a little hard to swallow sometimes. The legislature decides certain things there's strict liability for. And apparently in 174.02, they decided, hey, with dog bites... you're going to have strict liability if you're an owner, however defined. Where else is the strict liability that the legislature has decided, you know, we're not going to just rely on common law negligence. We're going to say, as a matter of law, you are strictly liable. This is what the legislature has decided. What other areas are there strict liability? Do any come to mind to you?
Some products liability cases.
Mm-hmm. Pretty rare, though, isn't it? I was thinking earlier this morning, where else do you have strict liability? And where the legislature has decided that this issue requires a statute of strict liability rather than resolving it on normal, ordinary negligence. And
yeah. My belief is it's probably because of the extent of injuries inflicted by dogs.
On kids, probably, mainly.
Yeah. Over half of that 368,000 would be kids under the age of 14.
Mm-hmm.
Injured. Thank you, Your Honors. That's all I have.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Hupfer?
Thank you, Your Honor. On specifically to the question I believe Justice Abramson posed to Mr. Siddle, that was in regard to the Jansen case. And I think in the Jansen case, the emphasis of the rationale for the court's decision has been missed a little bit and perhaps misrepresented in some of the briefs. But the focus in the Jansen case was not on the mother relinquishing her control to the animal hospital. The focus in that case of the language was the fact that the son stepped in and took control as a legal keeper. The court actually states in Jansen, where the keeper is not the owner, it may be assumed as a general proposition that the dominion or authority of the keeper over the dog is a limited one, subject to be terminated at any time by the owner. The moment the owner removes the dog from the custody of the keeper, the dual authority theretofore exercised over the dog by the owner and the keeper is merged in the owner, and at that very moment, the keeper's rights and responsibilities concerning the dog are at an end.
The court in there focuses on the owner taking the affirmative step. And I wanted to point that out because here the Court of Appeals in the decision in this case at the Court of Appeals level seems to say that the keeper here has to relinquish all care, all custody, all control before she stops being a keeper. And I think that's contrary to Jansen, because in Jansen the court talks about the owner, even states that even though he's an infant son, he's not the age of majority, but as the owner, once he steps in and takes control, that the keepership and the ownership all merge into him.
Counselor, but the statute back at Jansen didn't have the harbor or words in it, did it?
No, I understand it did not, although as Justice Bradley pointed out, it was mentioned in the Ketting case in the context of 174.05.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Counsel, do you want us to overrule Rotting?
Pardon me?
Do we have to overrule the Ketting case?
I think that the Ketting case should be overruled, yes. I think it's in conflict with Jansen. Even if you look at the concurrence in Jansen, which agreed with the majority's overall decision, the concurrence even points out in Ketting that it's not in accord with Jansen. I think that Jansen is much better reasoned. I think there's some problems with the reasoning in Ketting, as I pointed out in the main part of my argument, and I think it should be overruled.
If you withdraw that language in Fire Insurance Exchange, then that cites Ketting and its rationale with approval?
I'd have to look more carefully at that. If I just responded knee-jerk to that, I don't think it would be a fair representation, because I'd have to look at that a little more carefully to see what all Fire Insurance Exchange includes in its rationale.
Counsel, isn't there a general common theme where the liability was held under the strict liability statute? It seems to me that the person who is held liable as a keeper or harbor or owner had exercised, they keep using the phrase, dominion and control. But there was some decision-making authority there, too. There was responsibility for the feeding. And in the memorable turn of phrase from one of the cases, whether the dog would be fed from the family larder. Whereas that does not seem to be the case, at least on the record before us. Seafelt had no say over and no control, it doesn't appear, as to anything other than whether the dog was going to be allowed to stay in the house, only as part and parcel of her extending hospitality to the stranger. Are there cases where the individual has been held liable where the only thing they did was allow or countenance the presence of the dog as part and parcel of the extension of hospitality to the dog's owner?
No, I can't think of any. There was the case, and I'm not going to remember which one, I'll probably mix it up, where they tried to sue the restaurant owner because the people lived in the apartment above it, I believe, and the dog was in the restaurant quite a bit. Now, I understand that's a little bit different than what you're saying, but that's as close as I can get to it. And they said, no, that landlord wasn't responsible because he wasn't supplying the food. He wasn't caring for the dog, that type of thing. That's close. I agree it's different. The living quarters were different in that case, so it's not analogous. But you're correct, Your Honor, there isn't a case exactly with this situation.
The cases, as they have evolved, seem to describe the word keeper. And I see your time is up, so I'll withdraw the question. Mr. Rossmeisel, how do you pronounce your name? Rossmeisel? Counsel, you're representing the Pawlowskis.
That's correct.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Andy Rossmeisel. I do represent Ms. Pawlowski. Thank you for the opportunity to respond to a few of Ms. Hupfer's arguments on rebuttal. First of all, I would like to address Ms. Hupfer's statement that Keating is in conflict with Jansen. We do not believe that there is any conflict. First and foremost, once again, both the Keating and Jansen cases were decided under the old law, so it is worth at least mentioning that the definition of owner is more broad now than it was back when both cases were decided. Second, and more importantly, I go back to my co-counsel's likening of ownership to, likening of shelter to domicile. Like a person who goes to work during the day, that person is still domiciled and still resides at his or her residence. Just because a dog is temporarily taken out of a home or a residence or a structure, the dog still goes home and typically spends the night in that residence or domicile. In Ketting, that was exactly the case. The dog was taken to the park, but it was always intended that that dog's home was the owner's home. In this case, or in the Jansen case rather, the dog was taken to the animal hospital. It was intended that the dog would stay at the animal hospital until the owner or keeper returned to the animal hospital, picked up the dog, and changed the domicile or the residence of the dog back to the house. I realize it might seem a slight stretch to equate domicile, which we normally associate with people, to shelter, which we in this case associate with dogs. But if you look down the complete line of cases, that analysis would satisfy and would reconcile just about every case that this court has seen.
Could I ask you, what in your view should the Seafelts have done when people asked them to put up Mr. Waterman and his dogs?
Well, I think Ms. Seafelt, as well as any other resident of the state of Wisconsin, especially considering the statute and what the legislature has done, needs to think long and hard about letting somebody else's dogs live with them. Now, we have a different story if this is a landlord-tenant situation. But for reasons addressed before, this is not a landlord-tenant situation. One of the big differences here is that Ms. Seafelt lived in the same house, the same unit. If not right away, very soon after these dogs moved in, would have had the opportunity to come to know the dog's tendencies. But under this statute, and the legislature has already decided the public policy of the statute, under this statute, any owner of any property ought to be somewhat concerned before letting somebody else's dogs reside on their property.
Well, with all due respect, being somewhat concerned, I don't think it's the answer. If the Seafelts had come to you and said, "What do I do?" Wouldn't you have said, "Don't let the dogs come"?
Absolutely.
Where does Mr. Waterman live then?
Well, the fact of the matter is that it is not Ms. Seafelt's responsibility to take in Mr. Waterman. Sometimes people do things out of the goodness of their heart and break the law, and they're still held responsible if they break the law. In this case, Ms. Seafelt didn't break the law, but she made a decision, and unfortunately for Ms. Seafelt, she has to, in this case, accept the consequences of making that decision, because the legislature has already decided in situations like this that the term owner encompasses not only the legal owner of a dog, but also not only keeper anymore, but harborer. This definition keeps getting more expansive by the legislature.
Counsel, doesn't it seem to be that all the cases finding liability involve a parent-child relationship? And if not a parent-child relationship, it's where the one in Seafelt's place has some authority and control over the decision-making process of how the dog is going to be maintained, how it's going to be kept, whether it's going to be kept. You know, that phrase, as I mentioned to your opposing counsel, fed out of the family larder. Here there's nothing. We have this transient waterman. And there's no other legal relationship, not that the statute requires that, but there's also no other obligation or decision-making authority on Seafelt's part. Wouldn't this be an extension of the existing line of cases?
Your Honor, first of all, we don't believe that a parent-child parent-child relationship is relevant to the case.
Well, except that all the cases seem to involve parent-child. I know it's not a legal requirement. I think I said that in the question. But wouldn't this be, are there any other cases where someone extends hospitality to a transient such as Waterman and then is held liable for Waterman's dogs?
I don't believe that there's a, well, I believe that the closest case on point is Keating. And yes, that does Keating.
Father and daughter.
Well, it is a father-daughter. However, that is an emancipated or adult daughter.
But the court there went out of its way to indicate that the father made the decision-making authority, had the decision-making authority as to whether the dog was going to be fed.
Well, in this case, Ms. Seafelt had the authority to decide whether or not the dog would be in the house in the first place. So we think that this case is very much like Ketting, and we don't believe that the father-daughter relationship, because of the fact that she's an adult, is relevant at all. It was a gratuitous relationship, just like the...
I'm focusing less on the familial relationship and more on the decision-making authority of the harbor or keeper. Here it just seems to be that the dog is incidental to the presence of the transient, as opposed to the other cases where the owner or keeper or harbor actually had some decision-making and control over the dog's care and upkeep itself. That's all I was asking.
Your Honor, I note the red light is on. Do I have permission to answer? Thank you. Again, I think that this is an example why people like Ms. Seafelt need to think twice before allowing, number one, think twice before allowing a person on her, a transient stranger on her property, but think possibly three times before allowing a person with his strange dogs on the property. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Hupfer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to respond to a couple of points made by Mr. Rossmeisel, he started out by talking about domicile or shelter. But I think we come back to the idea whether we're talking about shelter, we sometimes seem to be using that synonymously for the word harbor, whether we're talking about harbor, keeper, or owner, we're talking about people who are supposed to be controlling a dog. They're supposed to be taking care of the dog or have some sort of dominion over it such that they can protect. Because the whole purpose of this statute is to protect third parties.
Is it your position that the statute says whoever has dominion over the dog is liable when the dog bites during that period of dominion? And any owner who doesn't have control and dominion at the time of the dog bite is not liable?
No, because I think there can be dual liability. And as I said earlier, I believe that the owner of the dog has kind of an umbrella, the legal owner of that responsibility.
So the owner is always liable.
I believe that that's kind of what Pfeiffer versus Dick says. I think that, and even Armstrong to some extent narrowed that a little bit.
Okay.
But yes, that's what I'm saying.
Owner is always liable. The keeper or harborer is liable only if it has custody at the time of the bite.
I think that's because keeper and harborer are more transient type situations.
That's your position.
I think if the legal owner has stepped in and taken control, yes. Otherwise, not. I think the legal owner would have to step in and take control. And also, the case law says repeatedly that the focus of the inquiry in determining whether one is a keeper of the dog for purposes of the statute is the moment of injury. Here, when the dog's owner, Waterman, intervened by stepping in and exerting dominion over the dog as he left the home to go to the store with his dogs, the dual authority of Waterman and Seafelt at least temporarily came to an end and merged in the owner. Seafelt was no longer responsible.
Can Seafelt only be responsible under your argument as a harborer if the injury occurs in her home?
My argument, assuming, let's say, Walter Waterman was nowhere around, he was not controlling the dog, that the legal owner was not controlling the dog, and the dog is in her yard and bites someone, I think she'd be responsible because she was harboring the dog and the legal owner had not stepped in and taken control. So I think in a situation like that, she would still be responsible.
So can she be a harborer if the dog is on the street, not in her backyard? I'm getting the dog off of her property. Is she a harborer of the dog?
Well, under Ketting, she would be. although I know they didn't necessarily have that word in the statute at the time, but under Ketting she would be. I don't know that she should be.
But under, know she what?
That I'm she saying. Should be, but under Ketting she
so
would
the law, that's why you want us to overrule Ketting.
That's correct.
Because under the law, that harbor, she can be responsible as a harborer even if the injury occurs off of her premises. That's the status of the law.
That's the status of the law now, yes, Your Honor.
And what's the purpose underlying this law? Why did the legislature decide, boy, with dog cases, we're going to have strict liability? I think maybe in civil cases they do with timber trespass. You know, we love our wood and we got to talk about dogs.
I think because they wanted to protect third parties and they wanted to relieve the plaintiff from the burden of proving negligence, because a lot of those old cases they were talking about proving the vicious propensity. Was the dog vicious? Or did he have a propensity to bite? They didn't want to have to go through that analysis anymore. So the strict liability part of the statute is in proving or is in the fact that the plaintiff doesn't have to prove negligence. However, the plaintiff still has to show to the court who should be responsible. So that inquiry doesn't end.
Part of the purpose, and you hit upon it, is set forth in case laws to protect innocent third parties. That's why there is strict liability. That's the purpose. And so shouldn't the statute be interpreted in light of the purpose?
Yes, I think it should. And I think
how does your argument that the law should be changed so that a owner, a harborer, is only a owner under the statute when the injury occurs on the premises? How does that promote the purpose of protecting third parties? Your argument that Ketting should be overruled and harborers' liability should be limited.
I think the liability should still be present, but the focus should be on the person who had the ability to prevent the bite. And
thank
I see
you,
my
counsel.
Light is red. Thank you.
I want to thank all the counsel, Ms. Hupfer, Mr. Siddell, and Mr. Rossmeisel, for their arguments today. This court has, over years, numerous dog bite cases, probably because a lot of kids and adults are bitten by dogs. And so we appreciate yet another dog bite case. And that ends our hearing in 07-AP-2651, Pawlowski versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company. The students should remain if they can. And Justice Filmsack will be out and talk with you. Everybody else is invited to stay.